Cliff Central. The revolution.
I've got something important to tell you.
CliffCentral.com.
Welcome. This is the Renegade Report, and well, it's our first show. It's actually an intro before our first show. So I'm Jonathan,
and I'm Ramon,
and yeah, it should be a good series. We're signed up for 6 of them. Hopefully, we'll get more. Otherwise, they'll probably throw us out of the building. That is, if the building hasn't been torched by then. You know, people get angry when you say things these days. You need to not offend them and their sensibilities. So why are we doing the show, Ramon?
Well, basically, we want to attack these nefarious ideas that are floating around our media and social media, especially lately. Most of these ideas have very little foundation to them. And we are trying to bring a bit of neoliberal propaganda in the form of statistics and data to challenge these ideas.
Statistics and data. Swear words. In 2016, those things are not liked at all. These are things people don't like you to bring to bear upon their theories and ideas. And from our side, I really think we came together to do the show because we both got quite frustrated with the fact that things just aren't interrogated very well. And there seems to be a sort of dominating kind of dialogue that happens. And as I know you don't like the word balance, but I quite like the idea that you're getting views from both sides and opinions from both sides and actually looking at the ideas, not the people. So we will try on the show as best as we can not to go after the people involved because we're not trying to take on people. We're trying to take on the ideas that they come up with and just interrogate that.
No, sure. But I mean, we're not on the other side of the narrative, so to speak. We are just going to discuss ideas in and of themselves. I'm an anarchist. Like, I don't have any political affiliations whatsoever.
You want the government to be gone.
Absolutely.
And then we will just, subsistence farm and build our own roads.
We'll just have thousands of little oranyas all over the place. Fantastic.
Oh, goodness. He said oranya, and it's not even... We're literally not even 3 minutes into the show and we're already discussing Orania. So let's avoid that topic until at least a little bit later on in the series. But these are the type of topics we want to discuss. So some of the stuff we're going to be going through.
So first of all, we're going to go through Roads Must Fall, the campaign and the movement. What the hell do they want?
What does decolonizing a university mean?
I thought it would be just nuking the whole place because universities are colonial.
Yeah, in essence.
Well, the first one was in Italy.
They're a European concept.
Absolutely.
Those darn Europeans.
So we're going to look at Roads Must Fall and look at what the hell they're on about. What exactly do they want? And most importantly, are the ideas worth anything?
Yeah, all right. So that's today's show. That's going to sort of come straight after this intro. And then as we go through the series, we've got a whole bunch of other shows we're going to talk about. So we've got a show on group politics and group identity and identity politics. So
talk about swear words.
Yeah, well, I mean, look, I imagine our show will be very oppressive to those people. Certainly that show will come with a trigger warning, I would imagine.
Well, they've burnt art. Can they burn people? We will find out.
Fair enough. And
I can say that because I have been burnt physically in the past. So.
Yeah, so there you go. It's okay. He can make the joke. He's literally had burns.
That's my experiences.
While we're going through all the topics, Renegade Report, how did we come to that?
Well, frankly speaking, was Taken, unfortunately. Yeah.
Damn it, Taken.
So was Focus. And so was Carte Blanche. So we like,
yeah, well, so, and I think we're combining a number of things here because it's a whole bunch of the stuff white people are scared of, and then it's actually tackling some of the stuff that really matters. So props to the shows that have tried to do that before, but we're actually going to allow voices to speak and be heard. We won't play down that the economy doesn't exist because of people's hurt feelings. That's kind of the group identity show dealt with then.
Yes.
What else we got coming up?
What else do we have? Oh, we got one on economics.
Oh, that'll be interesting.
So we have two students coming in to talk to us about that.
They've got quite a libertarian sort of slant on things.
Absolutely, and that will be a cracker, I think. Most people will either be infuriated or will be impressed. Hopefully both.
I think, look, if you're a true liberal, and there's not many of those left, or a libertarian, you'll probably like that show quite a bit. If you're left of liberal, you're going to get very annoyed. I'm hoping we can piss the conservatives off too. Because, you know, they're a little bit tight.
Do they still exist?
Well, in South Africa, surely. I mean, if we had a vote tomorrow on anything conservative, let's vote about gay marriage tomorrow in South Africa. I can guarantee you that it wouldn't be legal.
No, down all that filth. Who would have thought that two people in a room can bother me?
Exactly. Why shouldn't I be allowed to tell people what they can do in their own bedroom? I mean, really, ridiculous, ridiculous. So I think we've actually got a very conservative society, unfortunately.
I would tend to agree with you. Highly religious, very tribalistic. And I mean tribalistic in both ways. White people are also very tribalistic.
Don't call
me racist yet. It's not even 5 minutes into the show.
Well, we've done a run here and we almost 7 minutes it took you to go down that road. Almost 7 minutes. So you can see... Roman's going to say the crazy stuff, and then occasionally I will try to tell you how it fits in. We've also got a show on apartheid. That should be a killer.
That will be a killer. We've got
excuse the pun.
We got a lovely Indian man coming to talk to us about that, and the easiest way to get rid of apartheid mentality and groupthink. So that will be interesting to find out from him. The next show is on freedom of speech and satire in a liberal democracy which we don't live in at the moment.
Well, on paper we do. We've got a wonderful constitution.
Absolutely.
It's a liberal constitution.
It's a wonderful piece of paper.
Nobody really likes it. We know this. We know that the governing party has openly said they don't really believe in it. You know, you don't arrest a war criminal. I mean, you know, that's just, genocide is kind of okay.
No, but if
the Constitution doesn't really apply to all scenarios.
No, but like the Freedom Charter is another piece of paper, but that's somehow more important. Written by a bunch of communists in the 50s.
It's a good point, actually.
That piece of paper is far more important than this one.
Yeah, because of course we got sold down the river for the Constitution, don't you know? So these are some of the discussions we really want to have, and we want to interrogate these ideas because people say these outrageous things, and maybe they're correct, but then they must bring facts to bear. So you're going to listen to the show out there, we hope. If you don't, we'll just cry into our soup. But if you at any point, we're not live, so you can't call in to us, but you can write to us. You're welcome to send us an email. We have a Gmail account, very industrious of us.
Like most entrepreneurs.
Yes, absolutely. Well, you have to have a Gmail account, you know, and you get Google Plus and then you list it on a website somewhere. So renegadereportmailbox@gmail.com. It's quite long. renegadereportmailbox@gmail.com. Anything you don't like. We take death threats.
We take death threats, pornography.
Hate mail.
I insist on hate mail.
Hate mail is very important. In fact, we haven't done our job if we don't get some hate mail. We'll take that kindly. You can find both of us on Twitter. You might not find Ramon because he's been blocked by everyone, probably including you. So it's Roman. Yes, I will call him Roman on occasion, but it is Ramon. Underscore? Is it underscore? Is it just no underscore?
One word.
So it's Roman Cabanac, C-A-B-A-N-A-C. That's him on Twitter. And I'm Jonathan underscore Witt. And you can find us on Twitter where we sometimes say some vocal things. We usually say very offensive stuff that for some reason doesn't get us landed up in court. Isn't that odd?
It's deeply disappointing too for some reason.
Isn't it irritating that only the people in the public eye get nailed for saying stuff?
I mean, Gareth Cliff retweeted me and he was found in court, but I wasn't asked to go.
I actually forgot about this part. So Gareth ended up in court for actually commenting on Ramon's tweet. That was actually what happened.
Indeed.
In fact, Ramon commented on a poll tweet and Gareth commented on that, and that was the people just don't get freedom of speech. So if the show is annoying you, it's probably because you just don't get freedom of speech.
I think that's quite racist of you, John.
Indeed, racist, oppressive, and really, I'm showing my white privilege. That's what it comes down to. That's what it comes down to.
Well, that's all you have left, I'm afraid, after these podcasts come out.
Yeah, well, they will try, but we're gonna talk, we're gonna have discussions, and I'm really hoping that we're gonna make people think, even if you don't like us. I myself have discovered a whole bunch of podcasts on the web where I don't necessarily always agree with a guy. There's a guy called Ben Shapiro. He's a extreme right wing.
Yeah, but you just like him because he's Jewish.
Yeah, no, of course, you know that's you must always stick with your own. You know, he's very right-wing, and I don't agree with all his views, but occasionally, and not even occasionally, regularly, he says things that make sense. And just because I don't agree with everything he says doesn't mean I can't agree with some of the stuff he says.
You don't want to kill him in the public square?
No, I don't. It's funny, he actually went to a public speaking event yesterday, and they wanted to stop him from talking.
I heard that podcast this morning, actually.
Oh, and?
He was busy talking. He went anyway, even though he was so-called banned. He went anyway, gave the speech, and during the course of the speech, the liberal protesters, they switched on the fire alarm halfway through his speech. And he said, fuck you guys, I'm carrying on. And he did.
Fantastic.
And no one was hurt. That's an amazing thing.
Well, health and safety must have shat themselves. But I think we will also refer to a number of people we listen to as we kind of go through the series. Everyone from South Africans, so we're quite big fans of Gareth's show. And that's not just a punt because Cliff Central have been kind enough to give us a home. But we both think he's got quite sane views on things. Shows like the Czar podcast, which is Stephen Reardon's brainchild.
Czar is excellent. So in terms of local podcasts, there's actually not much out there other than Cliff Central.
I think those are the two big ones. And then there's some great stuff. You know, the Rubin Report is really excellent. There's some excellent guests. I'm quite a big fan of Sam Harris and his Waking Up podcast.
That's a very good one. But you just like both of them because is Sam Jewish? I don't know.
No, Sam's not originally, and now he's such an atheist. He definitely doesn't believe in anything. Although he is quite the meditating spiritualist.
Absolutely. He's an atheist spiritualist. I'm still wrapping my head.
No, I also don't quite get it. But there are many things. I think he's actually quite intelligent. There are many things I don't get that he does. I think it's because I'm not quite there yet.
But, I mean, other than those two, Joe Rogan is also quite nice.
Oh, yeah. Joe Rogan's not bad. You just got to pick your podcast because he's quite the sort of get into the martial arts kind of stuff.
Yeah, he is. His latest one is on evolutionary behavior, which is quite fascinating.
Interesting.
And other than that, if you really want your mind blown, you listen to a podcast called Rationally Speaking, which is based on European philosophy. I should have said a trigger warning
Just given a trigger warning. So those are some of our sort of inputs and some of the sort of podcasts we listen to, we admire. And we're hoping to get close with some of the South African topics, some of the stuff that's major in our dialogue every day, the things people are talking about. And we think people are talking about, because we need to constantly remind ourselves that Twitter is not real life.
Yes, believe it or not, it isn't real life. And another thing that we are trying to do is to show, well, hopefully you listeners, that different views from yours are okay in a democracy. I think that's the point. It's called competition of ideas, the marketplace.
You can have two ideas at once and the world does not end.
No, you don't have to try to kill someone for saying something.
Absolutely. And we'd all be much better off, I think, if we the sooner we all realized that and we all got to grips, even with the stuff that makes us uncomfortable.
Absolutely.
Cool.
Absolutely. So, there we go.
Nothing more to say for the moment?
Not for the moment.
So, we're going to end this part of the show and we're going to go straight into our guest for this week, and that will be Michael Cardo. So welcome to the Renegade Report. This is our first show, and as we mentioned in our intro, we're going to be discussing multiple topics. So this week, our guest is Dr. Michael Carter. He's a DA Member of Parliament. He's also the Shadow Minister of Economic Development, and he holds a BA Summa Cum Laude in English, French, and History from the University of Natal, as well as an MPhil and PhD in History from the University of Cambridge. So, without any further introductions,
this is CliffCentral.com.
Welcome to the show. Essentially, this week we chatted to you offline. We wanted to discuss Roads Must Fall. You wrote an article last year, which I thought was quite brave at the time, because you were one of the only people kind of sort of saying this probably isn't a good idea. You know, there was a lot of sympathy and support for the movement back then. And yeah. I suppose hindsight is 2020, and we can look at it now and sort of say, well, it didn't really necessarily turn out too well. But let's sort of go to the beginning and what your initial impressions were.
Sure. Well, I suppose I wrote that initial piece on the sinister underbelly of the Road Must Fall movement, which was published on the Politics website, because I was kind of taken aback, I guess, by the overwhelming decision of the University of Cape Town Senate to agree to the removal of Road Statue. I mean, I think the ultimate decision went by about 181 votes to one, which is remarkable. I mean, especially for a group of academics, you know.
That there was, there's no debate, essentially.
Absolutely. And, you know, academics aren't renowned for coming to a single point of view. Presumably, if you've got that many people in the room, the vote would have been split up. So something rang an alarm bell for me. It was unusual to have a decision which was sort of clamorously endorsed by a group of academics. And I really wanted to know why. So I started doing some research around the Roads Must Fall movement, which was very much in its infancy at that stage. I wrote this piece in March or April last year when the movement had started going. And I sort of started digging around their Facebook page, looked at some of the broadcast material that was available of some of the meetings that were held, looked at some of the opinion pieces that they'd started to write, and I really began to see traces of what looked like a pretty undemocratic movement, saying some pretty authoritarian things. And when I dug a little deeper, this became all the more clearer. But as I say, this was early days yet. The whole Roads Must Fall movement had just got off the ground. You know, Max Wehrli had only just thrown the feces at Rhodes' statue. I think those sort of nascent, incipient indicators of sort of intolerance, authoritarianism, have become much more pronounced today. And that sort of culminated in the burning of paintings, which, for me at any rate, really put the crypto-fascism of the Rhodes Must Fall movement front and center.
So, Michael, this is Roman. Hello again.
Hi, Roman.
Going back to the decision by the Senate, I mean, there could be other reasons for the decision other than listening to the Roads Must Fall movement. Do you think there could be a good argument that they pursued and that they accepted, or do you believe it was a bit hamstrung, or they were hamstrung rather?
I do believe they were forced into it, and especially if you look at the council decision that was taken later and which ended up ratifying the Senate's decision. I mean, that decision was arrived at in an atmosphere of absolutely intolerable pressure. You had a great number of students from the Road Must Fall movement outside the building in which the meeting had taken place. In fact, I think the venue was kept secret because there was an expectation that there would be protests. But anyway, the students managed to find out where this council meeting was taking place. And there was protest action that took place outside. And eventually, you know, the doors of the building were broken open. Members of the Roads Must Fall movement flooded in. and started chanting slogans like "One Settler, One Bullet." Now, that's hardly the kind of atmosphere conducive to sane, rational, sober decision-making.
Yeah.
So I do feel that, of course, it's entirely possible that a number of members of the Senate were persuaded by arguments in favor of the removal of the statue. But, of course, you must also bear in mind that that wasn't the only option available to them. You know, Rhodes could have been relocated to a position of lesser prominence on the campus. Another statue could have been erected of Nelson Mandela, for example, so that you would have them almost
juxtaposed.
There are a whole bunch of creative solutions. And in fact, if I recall correctly, L.B. Sachs wrote a very good piece which appeared in the Sydney Press at the time, exploring some of the other options that were available to UCT. So it's just very surprising that a group of academics who you would presume would be open to exploring the various options available to them seemed almost to capitulate. And that has begun a precedent, or it began a precedent, which has become more pronounced with the passage of time, because what you've seen, in effect, is the Rhodes Must Fall movement becoming increasingly violent, increasingly fascist, and that has in some way been facilitated by that very early and almost complete capitulation on the part of the UCT Senate.
But now, Michael, like, I think all three of us agree that Rhodes is not a liberal hero of any sorts.
Absolutely not.
Why would we want his statue to remain? If that's a claim we are making. I don't know if that's the one I'm making, but what benefit is there to leave it where it was?
Look, personally, I was never actually in favor of Rhodes remaining in the prominent position that he was in. I mean, he's at the bottom of the jammy steps. You know, he is almost a focal point of the campus. And you're quite right. He isn't a hero of the liberal tradition in South Africa. In that piece that I wrote, I pointed out that he was very much regarded, as he was, an imperialist jingo. And he was derided by the likes of Olive Schreiner in her book, Trooper Peter Halkett of Mashonaland, in which she excoriated him in his native policy. So he doesn't belong to the liberal tradition in South Africa, even though I suspect there is an assumption made by many of those involved with the Rhodes Must Fall movement that he does somehow embody something quite essential about white liberalism in South Africa, which I think is entirely wrong. But anyway, to get back to your question, I think that, you know, it may have been a better idea, as I said earlier, if he had been juxtaposed with a statue of Mandela, or if indeed he had been moved elsewhere on the campus.
I think from my perspective, you know, the other point to make about it, which has been made again and again with regards to the history, is that go back to that time and try find what you would sort of deem to be a liberal and anyone with sort of progressive type of views, and you're not going to find many people at that sort of time in history. Is that a fair argument, the whole historical argument, and that you can't kind of erase history even though there were very bad people, you know, at many parts of history?
Well, I wouldn't go along with you insofar as you suggest that there was, you know, a complete dearth of liberals in South Africa at the time. I mean, the fact is that liberalism is in fact probably the oldest political tradition in South Africa. It stretches back hundreds of years, and it was a particularly vibrant and vital political tradition in the Cape Province, as it was then known. And in fact, Olive Schreiner, who I mentioned, you know, was a great embodiment of the liberal tradition. But I take your point that, I mean, he was a product of his time, and he was also, it must be said, a particularly pernicious product of his time. I mean, he wasn't a great guy. You know, yes, he was a generous benefactor to both the University of Cape Town and indeed to Oxford University, where the Rhodes Must Fall movement has met with much less success But to answer your question, Rhodes was in fact not somebody who I think would be held up by people who regard themselves as liberals in South Africa as any sort of flag bearer for the liberal tradition, and certainly no kind of hero. I mean, I would very much like it to be realized that he wasn't a liberal, and in fact, he doesn't belong in the liberal tradition.
So now, Michael, now going back to the movement itself, earlier in our conversation, you just called them fascists. Mm. That is a loaded term. What do you mean by them being fascists?
Well, I mean a couple of things. They're certainly authoritarian. They have quite a totalitarian worldview. They have no regard for individual autonomy. You know, if you look at the discourse that's employed by the Rhodes Must Fall movement, it's all about bodies who are sort of shaped by structures and systems and historical forces beyond their control. So there's a profound kind of rejection of the liberal conception of the individual. There's a profound rejection of the liberal conception of individual agency and autonomy, and that goes hand in hand with a very authoritarian enforcement of conformity. Another key characteristic of what I would regard as an essentially fascist movement is its complete intolerance of dissent, its disregard for rational dialogue and debate. Thirdly, its belief that its demands are non-negotiable. So, you know, there's no brokering involved. There's no rational discussion and an attempt to meet a solution halfway. But also, interestingly, insofar as discourse is concerned, there's almost a kind of aestheticization of pain and suffering on the one hand, black pain and black suffering on the one hand, and this notion of white privilege, which we can talk about more in due course, certainly, on the other. So there's this sort of totalitarian binary way of looking at the world. And anything that doesn't fit into that frame of reference is kind of violently rejected, which accounts, I suppose, for the movement's increasing recourse to violence and intimidation, which culminated in the art burnings of a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, so for me, you know, reading your article and then also reading some responses to your article, because you wrote your piece and Gareth van Onselen wrote a piece around the same time dealing with the concept of Rhodes Must Fall and white privilege and that whole idea. You know, Jacques Rousseau responded. I don't know if you've read that, but part of what he said was that essentially both yourself and Gareth gave UCT too little credit and exaggerated the likely consequences of the Rhodes statue removal. And for me, it's kind of, well, at that time, either of you could have been right, you know. Maybe it was just a statue removal and nothing more. And I think that most people who supported the movement went, well, you know, he was a bad guy. He certainly shouldn't hold a prominent place, as you agree, and I do too. And so most people went with it. You know, those of us who looked at this sort of movement, which, as you mentioned, reacted to any kind of opposition with violence, really, and refused to debate on any level, sort of saw the fascism in it and kind of predicted the point where we are now, where we have a very sort of dangerous movement, which I suppose, you know, in many respects, and I think a lot of people feel burning art is just sort of the pinnacle of the most barbaric thing you can possibly do. So, you know, what's your sort of feelings now on how we got here and the people that might not have seen us this coming and where we're going next with this?
Well, I mean, I don't really know if I agree with the argument, and it's a long time since I read Jacques Rousseau's piece and the piece that Gareth van Onselen wrote at the time of the statue being removed. But, I mean, I don't really buy the argument that had the statue not been removed, then the consequences for UCT and the administration would have been too ghastly to contemplate, and that it would have, you know, opened up a Pandora's box. I mean, the fact is that the statue has been removed and Pandora's box has been opened. You know, where does it all end? The fact that art was burned, the fact that on another campus at the University of the Northwest, the science building was burned. I mean, it does suggest that these kind of nascent traits of fascism, which were an early display, have now themselves been inflamed and caught fire. So, you know, I'm not of the view that the policy of appeasement would have worked. In fact, it's been clearly shown not to have worked. And in fact, have had many, many, many ugly consequences.
Well, Michael, I'm on the Roads Must Fall Facebook page, and this was written in April 9th, 2015. And it clearly says, the second last paragraph, "We must not forget that management are our colonial administrators, and their removal of the statue is merely an attempt to placate us and to be perceived as sympathetic. Our freedom cannot be given to us. We must take it." So, I mean, it was quite clear, even a year ago, that it was not about a statue. It never was.
And if you also look at the concept of the university as articulated by the Roads Must Fall movement. You know, its definition of the university is that the politics of the movement clearly dictate an antagonism to the liberal university and its conception, as they say, with particular reference to the role of the post-colonial elite institution in maintaining the status quo, which we unambiguously desire to deconstruct. So this project of decolonization, as articulated, insofar as it's been articulated by the Roads Must Fall movement, and some of it I think is a fairly incoherent articulation, it's pretty clear that this is a project of deconstruction, of tearing down, of breaking up. There's no forward-looking, visionary statement of what it is that a decolonized university would look like.
Yeah, well, absolutely. If I can jump in there, I mean, I sit at on a committee at Wits University, and for the past sort of almost a year, we've constantly been told by student reps, you know, that the university needs to be decolonized. And I constantly ask what that means, and I never actually get an answer. Because, you know, if you could express what that stands for, maybe I would agree with part of it. But I'm not sure if you have a better grasp on what that actually entails?
Well, look, I think a lot of these terms that are employed by what I call the identitarians, you know, the student movement that's very heavily invested in
a wonderful term,
quite vicious form of identity politics. And it's not only racial identity politics, it's gender identity politics, it's every imaginable kind of identity politics that you can think of. But a lot of these terms, like whiteness, like white privilege, like decolonization, like even black pain for that matter, aren't very clearly articulated and defined. They tend to mean anything you want them to mean.
Having said that,
I mean, to be fair to the Roads Must Fall movement, I mean, I do think that they have enunciated certain core concepts in their agenda. So, for example, they've been quite insistent about implementing curriculum reform, which is Africa. You know, they want African discourses to be the point of departure in humanities through content of what's taught in classes, but also through language, methodologies of education and learning. So there is a kind of anti-Eurocentric, Afrocentric to curriculum reform. There's also been a strong demand around.
We're breaking up a little bit on your line.
Okay, can you hear me now?
No, this line is poor. So what I'm going to do is we're going to take a short break. We're going to pick you back up on the Afrocentric part when we come back.
Download the Cliff Central app, available now on the Apple App Store and Google Play Store.
Right, and we've managed to get Mark back on the line, so we can continue with the conversation. Sorry, as you were saying.
Yeah, so the first point I made was around the Eurocentric curriculum, what's perceived to be a Eurocentric curriculum that privileges the Western canon and the humanities. The second aspect would revolve around the representation of black lecturers across faculties at UCT. You know, there's this feeling that there are limitations in place on the access of black academics to senior positions. So there's a call for that to be revised. And then the various other aspects which I seem to recall them highlighting at the time as part of the decolonization agenda was to change the admissions policy quite fundamentally, so to adopt an admissions policy that explicitly uses race as a proxy for disadvantage and thus prioritizing black applicants.
All right, so thanks for explaining that, because some of it makes sense and some of it I can't actually disagree with. For example, certainly the academic pool should, over time, become more representative of the group of people we have in this country. But I think it was a point you actually did make going along the lines of it takes time to get a professor. It's something that just doesn't happen overnight if you want quality, essentially.
Exactly. It's the point that's been made by the UCT administration on numerous occasions, and that is that it takes more than 20 years from obtaining a PhD, which is your kind of trade union ticket into academia, to becoming a professor. So as I wrote in the piece, the pool of black South African academics available for appointment to professorship in 2016, for example, would depend on the pool of black PhD graduates 20 years beforehand in 1996. And there aren't any quick fix solutions to increasing that pool. You need a much more sustainable long-term solution, which is really to improve the quality of the public education system that pumps the pool 20 years down the line. Another thing to be borne in mind, I suppose, too, is that a career in academia is not always that attractive for a highly qualified black graduate. You know, you're going to earn much more money in the private sector, or even in the public sector for that matter, than were you to stay on as a university lecturer.
Now, Michael, there was the initiator, Mr. Maxwell, I believe was his name, of yes. Rosemont's Fall. He's not a young man anymore. He's been a student for a number of years.
I think he's in his mid-30s.
Yes, so he's been a student for almost a decade, I believe, or a bit more than that. What would someone like that, why would he initiate this? Is it seeking political office? I don't really understand.
Yeah. Look, I mean, I don't really know enough about Mr. McSweely's personal situation to sort of pronounce authoritatively on the reasons for his being involved. I mean, one of the points that I did make in a subsequent follow-up piece that I wrote on the problem with racial identity politics was that the whole political culture of student politics and student protest has kind of shifted. So I think there's something symbolically quite significant in Maxwelly choosing to fling feces at the statue while captured on camera in doing so. And I do think that there is a tendency within this identitarian student movement to be quite narcissistic, so that politics doesn't become a rational attempt to solves differences between different role players. But it actually becomes a very self-regarding, highly inward-looking, narcissistic phenomenon that, yes, you do get your 15 minutes of fame, and, you know, you do get your mug put all over the news channels. So, you know, I would suspect that there was some kind of self-promotion agenda behind his decision to do that. But that's really just the suspicion. I mean, I can't say what his motives were.
No, certainly so. I mean, we don't expect you to speak on his behalf, of course. But now, going back to something we've discussed, they want to diminish whiteness, so to speak, in tertiary education. Do you have any idea what they mean by that?
I've got some vague notion. Look, you know, I actually came to this stuff by way of my honors year, which was quite a long time ago, in 1998, when critical race theory was beginning to be popularized in South African humanities faculties and social sciences departments. And it was all the rage. I mean, this is a sort of a function of South African academia, or certainly the humanities at any rate. We kind of go through saddish phases. So in the 1970s and 1980s, everybody was a Marxist in the humanities faculty. In the 1990s, everybody was a post-colonial theorist. And in the late 1990s, critical race theory had begun washing up on our shore, and everybody was sort of examining whiteness, and whiteness studies was beginning to become a discipline. So I had done some reading around whiteness and white privilege. The key text in this regard is, or the key texts in this regard are really authored by a man called David Roediger. And the kind of key features of whiteness are that it's socially and it's politically constructed, that it's not just your skin color. So, you know, it goes beyond that. Whiteness is based on a whole bunch of beliefs and values and behaviors and habits and attitudes. But the key thing in and among all of those things, beliefs, values, behaviors, habits, and attitudes, is that power is distributed unequally, and it's based on one's skin color. So you hold a certain position of power within the system of whiteness. If you are white, you are privileged. If you are black, you are disadvantaged. You have diminished agency, and you operate essentially in a white world. The other key point to be made about whiteness, or what scholars of whiteness studies would argue, is that whiteness is a kind of unconsciousness. It's a lack of awareness. So whiteness is frequently, in fact, usually always, invisible to white people. They can't see their whiteness. They can't see their white privilege. And this lack of awareness, this inability to see one's whiteness and one's white privilege, leads to a fundamental lack of understanding about what causes oppression, and what causes structural advantage and structural disadvantage, which is why I think you see this kind of virtue signaling competition among white scholars of whiteness studies, who get very excited when they kind of discover their own whiteness, and who announce it to great fanfare. It sort of becomes a competition among them to see who can be more aware of their whiteness and to extol it very proudly, which is why, you know, often in the pieces that I do write, I find those people particularly insufferable.
Okay, so you've said a lot there, and I think it's an important discussion to have, because it's really the kind of the dialogue that comes from Roads Must Fall, which is, they kind of dismiss you based on groupthink, essentially. So if you're a white male, then you know you can't comment on it because you don't know their struggle. But isn't that in itself racist, that all white people are privileged and all black people are suffering? Isn't it in itself to put people into boxes based on their skin?
Well, it's certainly very simplistic and binary. Look, I mean, as I said in that initial Rosanna School piece that I wrote, this notion of white privilege is quite seductive at a superficial level, because the fact is that apartheid was a grand system of white privilege. There's no getting away from that. I mean, it was a system of white preferencing. It was a system of white preferment. And yes, if you were white, you benefited from it. And yes, even though apartheid ceased to be in 1994, the fact is that there are certain generational consequences, and that the benefits and privileges that were enjoyed by, you know, people of our parents' generation or our grandparents' generation, for certain, do get handed down. And the fact was that apartheid did deprivilege, for want of a better word, black South Africans in a fairly fundamental way. In a fairly number of fundamental ways, key among which was the fact that there was a sort of interruption of wealth accumulation over generations. So I don't seek to dismiss out of hand this notion of white privilege, although I do resent the way in which it's become such a packaged concept. And then it's used almost as a kind of a, what Robert Conquest, the historian of Soviet Empire, would call a brain blindfold or a mind blocker and a thought extinguisher. You know, it tends to shut down conversation.
Yeah.
People say, carry on.
Sorry, Michael. I mean, I think most rational people can agree that apartheid was an unequal system. I don't think there's any reason to believe otherwise based on evidence, and that those consequences and advantages still happen to come through to this day. But those things can be explained through political or economics. They can be explained through a whole lot of other things. But somehow, white privilege is seen as almost original sin for Marxists, if you know what I mean. A lot of advantages and societal advantages that whites have or don't have can be explained economically. I mean, we do understand why people are better educated, for example. We do understand why people are in management positions because they have skills available to them. Well, the majority of black people don't. Now, those can be explained economically. Why don't these people do so then? They use it almost like a sledgehammer as opposed to an argument.
Well, I think because a number of the most vocal proponents of the discourse of whiteness and white privilege are frankly economically illiterate. So certainly in academia, this thing had its genesis in departments of literary and cultural theory. A number of philosophers have been at the forefront of trying to analyze whiteness and white privilege. And the fact is that I don't think they're particularly interested in the sort of economic and structural aspects. And the effect of that is that whiteness and white privilege have turned into a form of identity hand-wringing. And they've been essentialized in such a way as to make them precisely that, a kind of essential part of what it means to be white or to have a white identity. So I don't think there's any rigorous attempt to understand the structural nature of white supremacy, of the history of apartheid. It's all kind of descended into vast generalizations around identity and some fairly essentialist notions around privilege and around whiteness.
Yeah. No, I would tend to agree with you. I do find the conversation lacks a lot of data. I mean, the data is there, but that can be explained through other means. I just find, do you believe that there is a sort of industry building around this notion? Because a lot of books are being written about it. A lot of people actually have jobs writing about it. I think it's economically quite fruitful for these opinionistas.
Absolutely. Whiteness and white privilege has become a veritable cottage industry, and a lucrative one at that. So not only is it popular inside the academy, not only is every English lecturer and philosopher and professor of gender studies writing about whiteness, but it's also become quite popular and lucrative outside of the academy. So you've got a number of people within the intelligentsia whose pieces you see in the op-ed pages of our daily newspapers who write about nothing but whiteness and white privilege. There's a whole group of them, and I do think there is some sort of bandwagon effect at play here. These people are positioning themselves in the vanguard of the intellectual vanguard of racial populism, which is why it's very difficult for them to come out, for example, and categorically condemn what happened at UCT with the art burning a couple of weeks ago. You know, they'll sort of wring their hands and say, yes, but, you know, this is kind of violence in response to institutional violence. And what can you expect these students to do?
Surely that can't be justified on any level. I mean, you surely cannot stand by with burning of art, burning of buildings, as we saw a few days ago, and sort of say, well, you know, these are people who've been, you know, oppressed for however long, and they feel X amount of pain over this, or you categorize the pain according to race, and then you kind of justify the violence. Have we lost the point at which we believe that almost violence is kind of the last resort, and certainly it doesn't seem like we've reached that point, or have we?
Well, I mean, to answer your question, yes, you would think that people wouldn't respond in that way because the burning of art is so profoundly irrational. It's so profoundly anti-intellectual that you would expect people with intellectual and or academic pretensions to denounce it categorically and emphatically. But the fact is that, you know, there's almost a kind of radical chicness associated with being part of the student movement and with lending your voice and your support as a public intellectual to the student cause. So you don't want to be seen to be undermining that cause. And the effect, of course, is a form of self-censorship. You decide to hold your tongue. And that becomes very, very dangerous when it starts to become ingrained in the intellectual space, because then you don't start identifying what is essentially a fascist movement. You don't start identifying the trends. You end up not being able to see where it's going to end up. And that is a profoundly bad phenomenon.
Michael, what do you think of the phenomenon of the liberals? Well, in inverted commas, liberals took over the universities in the 70s and the 80s, and now they are being eaten by their children, so to speak. So I do find that the response from the universities, touching on the points we made much earlier, the response has been so inadequate, so lacking in authority, almost. It's almost like they want to sympathize with the protesters and try to sort of tell them that they're wrong at the same time. It's a strange dichotomy there.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't want to be a vice chancellor at this time in South African history. I mean, I do think it must be one of the most difficult jobs in the country at the moment.
And dangerous, and with firebombs coming into your office. And
absolutely,
dangerous.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So, you know, I don't want to be glib and make rash statements about what should and shouldn't have been done. Other than to say that if you capitulate from the word go, if you cave in, as I do think the UCC Senate did with that overwhelming vote, you set yourself up for grave problems down the line because things only become worse. So that's one way of answering your question. The other is, you know, I'm not sure that many of the vice chancellors would regard themselves as liberals who are now being eaten by their children. I mean, gosh, you know, if you look at the record of some of our vice chancellors, I don't think they would consciously self-identify as part of the liberal tradition in South Africa. You know, somebody like Max Price, for example, I think was probably a very left-leaning student himself. Certainly Adam Habib, the vice chancellor of Wits, was, you know, positively a Trotskyite in his day. So I'm not quite sure.
And remains to some extent.
Yes, although I think he's written some very sensible stuff of late on what's been happening at Wits and around the violence. And he's been quite vocal. He had quite a good piece in one of the Sunday newspapers this weekend past. And I think he's very alive, just following on social media, to the kind of point of no return that's been reached at an institution like the University of the Northwest. You know, when you start burning down buildings, well, as he rightly said on Twitter, the people who will bear the consequences of that worst, who will suffer the most, are in fact the poorest of the poor students who now have to get out of res, who have to leave the campus. They don't necessarily have alternative arrangements. It's just a disaster.
But Michael, do you think that vice chancellors have forgotten that they're actually managers? They're not actually elected by the students in any way, shape, or form. They are there to manage the university. Do you think they've actually forgotten about that? Like, do they think they are somehow beholden to students and, you know, to their whims?
So that's for sure. Yes, you are right. I mean, they are administrators and they are charged with managing what are essentially very, very complex institutions with a multiplicity of stakeholders, all of whom have differing agendas. So they have a complex job. What I think can be said and what I'd like to reiterate is that the policy of appeasement that was followed by some vice chancellors right at the get-go with working in a school, for example, has backfired spectacularly. So, you know, if the Northwest University happenings produce anything of beneficial consequence, it will hopefully be that a line in the sand will now be drawn so that when students do commit acts of what are patently criminality, the law must take its course. You know, students who engage in arson, students who burn down things, should be arrested and should be tried. And that university administrators shouldn't cave in to student pressure for charges to be dropped and the like.
Yeah, well, I mean, isn't this just kind of the chickens coming home to roost? You know, you have a situation last year where people want a statue gone and they spray paint and they, you know, it's minor sort of petty crime in essence. They spray paint and they smear feces on things and they you know, they do a whole bunch of things that are distasteful or at minimum or maximum, I suppose, a petty type of crime. And it gets left alone because it's kind of sort of seen as part of the protest and you don't really want to pick on anyone for a small thing. But if you don't say no to these things, you kind of end up at the point where we are now.
Absolutely. It's a vicious cycle.
What is your view on the claim that these students want free tertiary education? Because I'm of the view that it is a pity that people are excluded due to financial constraints, and there must be a way to ameliorate that. But do you think free tertiary education could be something the state could look at? I mean, first of all, that they're fighting the state by proxy through universities, and somehow they want the same state to give them free education benevolently, which I find a bit ironic, but nevertheless. Can free tertiary education be something that we can afford at this stage?
Well, I know at one stage that the South African Institute of Race Relations was doing research into the viability of free education. And their initial findings were that it was indeed possible. Now, you know, the South African Institute of Race Relations is very much a classical liberal think tank. So, you know, they're not a think tank that you would automatically say would come out in support of the students. So they think it's possible. But the point that I would make is that the crisis that we find ourselves in today, you know, it has a fairly long history. In fact, it has a history spanning the two decades of our democracy, because the fact is that higher education has been severely underfunded for 20 years. So these vice chancellors, these university administrators, they are in a very, very difficult position, not of their own making, because going hand in hand with the severe underfunding of universities over a 20-year period is the fact that, you know, numbers have been increasing. 100% of newcomers to universities are from poor backgrounds. And the government hasn't come to the party with regards to university funding. So it hasn't invested consistently in infrastructure, in research equipment, in laboratories and classrooms and maintenance and all those things. And the funding, the government subsidy, just hasn't kept pace. So in a way, this crisis, even though it goes beyond just funding, I mean, you know, this isn't just about fees must fall, it's about, well, it's about identity politics over and above that. The fact is that government is to some degree, in fact, to a very large degree, responsible for the funding crisis that besets universities. I think it's something like a 17 billion gap in funding at the moment. And some of the ways that we would need to go about addressing that would be to ramp up the offering of NSFAS, you know, and to improve the administration of NSFAS, to make it more streamlined, to make it more efficient. And yes, we do also have to engage partners outside of government. So, for example, you know, an idea has been mooted that you engage with the banking industry to find ways to expand more loans to students in the middle, that you try tie student repayments of loans to the tax systems, as happens in Australia, to help secure repayments, and then empowering universities, boosting universities' capacity to raise private funds. But the bottom line is that this is, in some degree, a crisis of the government's own making.
Yeah,
and
so
you know, it would be better to actually channel one's frustration to the government itself. I think a lot of the frustrations that are channeled towards university vice chancellors, that's actually a little bit unfair.
Well, that's
because they aren't.
That's what I kind of, you know, it's you think it's what you, you know, you referred to kind of as the economic illiteracy earlier, or do you think it's just more political in that, you know, you rather blame whiteness or you rather blame a vice chancellor and management and the colonialists and, you know, all these kind of victimhood descriptions and ways of thinking rather than the obvious fact, which is, the government provides basically tertiary education. You know, you pay a portion when you go to university, but obviously it's all subsidized to some extent. So if you know, you might want to pick on the colonialists as your enemy, but in essence, your major enemy here is the government that hasn't adequately planned.
Absolutely. And I think there's some kind of unwillingness to stare that truth squarely in the face. You know, in as much as the scholars of whiteness studies like to say that whites are blind to their own privilege and blind to the benefits of whiteness.
I can assure you when I pay tax every month, I am not blind to anything.
I think there's an unwillingness on the part of students to apportion blame and responsibility to the democratic government, to the ANC government. It's far easier to pin the blame elsewhere. And this is very much a trait of racial identity politics. You know, racial identity politics is so heavily invested in grievance and blame, but because of the way in which racial mobilization works, it becomes so much easier to target that grievance and blame to this kind of amorphous notion of whiteness. Whiteness is responsible for our plight. When in fact, the government itself has made various critical missteps along the way, and the underfunding of universities over a 20-year period is a key misstep which has produced this overall situation.
Michael, there's a very easy way to solve all these issues at once, and that is just to make Wi-Fi a human right, access to the internet. People can study wherever they want to. No outsourcing of workers will need to happen because universities won't exist. It'll be much cheaper to study online. And you can study anything you want without having to come into contact with white people, if you so choose.
This is Ramon the Anarchist speaking.
But it's a simple process, I think. Why not just protest for free Wi-Fi all over the land and let people choose what they want to study at home or wherever they wish?
Ramon, I think that's an ideal answer to the problems which we are faced with. You know, the fact is that it is very important to have a physical university for a whole number of reasons, but one of which I'll touch on, is that you say, well, wouldn't it be better to have this all online so that, you know, students wouldn't have to engage with white students? I mean, if you go down that road, it is, I think, giving up on the non-racial project. It is a giving up on the constitutional settlement of 1994. The fact is that we do want black students and white students living and working and studying together on campus. And I think it would be a profoundly unsatisfactory development if anything was done to jeopardize that. You know, these institutions must be spaces that are non-racial and in which black students and white students learn to live with one another and to get on with one another. Because, you know, for me at any rate, that's what the South African project is about. It's about creating the sort of non-racial, non-sexist, democratic society that's envisaged by our constitution. Interestingly, there's a huge loss of faith among the members of the Rhodes Must Fall movement and the various other identitarian student movements in the legitimacy and the validity of the constitution and in the legitimacy of the negotiations that produced the constitution.
Yeah.
So, you know, one of the reasons why I get quite seized with what's going on at our university and why I get quite seized with identity politics is because, you know, beneath the surface, there's something deeper going on. And that something deeper is actually a profound assault on our constitutional settlement. It's a profound assault on the legitimacy of our constitutional institutions. It's a profound assault on non-racialism. I mean, that's what whiteness is. Whiteness and white privilege, it's an assault on non-racialism. Now, I'm not saying that you have to be some sort of colorblind, rainbowist, living in a fantasy world where, you know, you
hashtag
don't see
I'm colorblind.
Yeah, I for one don't go in for that kind of thing.
Me neither.
I do think that colorblindness has been misused, and I do think that it's naive in a way to talk about colorblindness. But I do strongly believe that our salvation as a country which is a complex, plural, divided society because of our history of dispossession, that the answer lies in non-racialism, not in this kind of binary notion of whiteness and blackness, which is really a kind of identity chauvinism that inevitably leads to racial polarization. It inevitably leads to the scenes that we saw on the rugby field at the University of Free State earlier this week. It just tends towards polarization.
Yeah.
And, you know, we made those decisions in the run-up to 1994 for a whole host of complex, historically specific, contextual reasons. And I do think that there is almost a kind of ahistoricism on the part of a young generation of students who just regard Nelson Mandela as a sellout, who regard the people who struggled to produce our constitution as complete sellouts. And I think that's based on a fundamental misreading and a misunderstanding and a lack of appreciation for the very, very fraught environment in which our constitutional settlement was arrived at.
Yeah. So, I mean, I agree with all of that. I wonder sort of kind of, you know, to sort of end off, because I think we've kind of gotten into the whole roads must fall and we've discussed them and, as you say, there's a fascist nature to them. I just wonder if we don't stop them here. And I have to be honest, I'm quite glad to see that there are some voices a lot more than there were sort of 8 months ago who are kind of waking up to the potential danger that they pose. But I'm just wondering if we don't stop them here, kind of if we imagine them in a very powerful position, if you kind of gave the leaders of this organization the country for a month and you said to them, here you go, here's the whole cabinet and you're the kind of president, deputy, et cetera, where do we end up? Because it doesn't seem like a very good place.
No. You end up with complete destruction of institutions. You end up with a series of scorched earth policies. And quite frankly, you end up, to answer your question, with an EFF government. That's the natural end of, that's the natural end point of this kind of economically illiterate racial identity politics run amok. It's an EFF government. That's what you're looking at. I'm not saying that an EFF government is going to come into existence, far from it. But I do think that there are certain similarities with the politics espoused by the identitarian student movement and with the EFF. So it's very clear now, it's become increasingly clear that the EFF is stoking some of this racial violence on campuses. It seems very clear that the EFF was behind or supportive of the violence that erupted at the University of the Northwest the other day. It seems clear, Max Price himself has said in an opinion piece on the weekend, that the EFF is trying to embed itself in student politics at the University of Cape Town and is driving some of the violent excesses in the Roads Must Fall movement. So that's really what we need to guard against.
Okay. It's quite interesting, I mean, in terms of the politics, it seems that at many points throughout this there have been different political motives involved and at least from my perspective, parties, because the ANC was more than happy to climb on this bandwagon previously. And certainly this year it seems to be their election strategy. The ANC is not racist. Everyone else is. So vote for us. And your biggest problem in the country is racism. And I have to be honest, if I put it on a list from 1 to 10, I don't think racism even classifies in the top 10 of our problems, actually. So it's quite interesting because I think in terms of identity politics and this whole sort of victimhood, everyone kind of climbs on the bandwagon at some point.
Yeah. Look, I'm not sure that I would, not that I'm saying you're suggesting that racism is completely unimportant, but I mean, you know, racism is a thing in South Africa. I don't think we can deny that. I mean, how could it be otherwise after centuries of racial domination? I mean, the fact is that racism does exist in South African society. But yes, you are quite right. The ANC is using it as a diversionary election tactic. And it's easy to do so. You know, the politics of racial mobilization, our history has shown, well, any society that has racial cleavages has shown, in fact, the politics of racial division, of racial mobilization, of racial polarization, they are so easy. It's such an easy way of engaging in political life.
Yeah. All right. I think, we'll end it off there before we get too political. I think it's been a good discussion on Roads Must Fall, and I would certainly hope that they've kind of reached their end point at this stage. I'm not sure they will, because they do seem to be a quite passionate bunch. But I certainly would hope that we see them decline, certainly, especially after the latest violence that we've seen. Ramon, anything from you?
I think that there's certainly been a turning of the tide in the wake of what happened last week at UCT with the burning of paintings. I do think that the movement has lost a substantial amount of public sympathy and support, and that people who were kind of broadly sympathetic to it in the past have now begun to ask questions. Also, you know, before we go, I do want to say one thing. It's very easy to get trapped into thinking that the kind of discourse employed by the identitarians and the student movement sort of have much broader significance in our national life than in fact they do. You know, to some degree, some of the stuff happens in a bubble. And if you were to go out into, an informal settlement and begin to talk about whiteness and white privilege, I'm sure people would look at you with a blank expression on their face. So there is a danger of kind of blowing this stuff up into more than it really is.
Yeah, sure. I think that's a valid point.
Yeah, social media and its effects are not as great as we think.
True.
All right, Michael. Well, thank you so much for joining us. Very good to have you. I think, yeah. Hopefully people will react accordingly to this.
Thanks so much.
The pleasure that is all ours. And we wish you a great weekend.
It was great to talk to you. Good luck with the show.
No, thank you so much, Michael.
Thanks for joining us.
Keep well.
Cheers, eh?
Thanks, Jonathan. Ciao. Bye.
Bye.
Right. So that was Mark Cotto from the DA. Ramon, any comments?
Well, a lot of truth bombs, I must be honest. I hope our audience can take it without committing suicide or spontaneously combusting. We're dealing with a bunch of people who might have legitimate concerns and some that I may sympathize with. But I do think the manner in which that is done is very important. And they are certainly not gaining my sympathy at the moment, because the thuggish behavior is not warranted by any means.
Yeah, I mean, as I said, I really hope that they've sort of almost burnt out. I know that's hardly the politically correct thing to say, but we don't intend to be politically correct all the time on this show. I hope that we've seen the last of them, to be honest. It's just not conducive to the national dialogue, in my opinion.
Yeah, I'm not too sure we have seen the last of them, to be honest. I do have a feeling this is sort of the beginning, but we'll need to see the blowback from the burning of the science labs at NWU.
Yeah, and in the meantime, there's a whole bunch of students who just don't get to go to university this year.
isn't progressivism so great?
It's just marvelous. All right, so that's our show for the week, and we'll see you next week. Thanks so much for listening, and till next time.
Don't forget to send your hate mail.
Cliff Central.
The revolution. I've got something important to tell you.
CliffCentral.com.